So I'm going to talk tonight, chapter 9, goodwill and hatred. I'm going to talk about hatred first so we can leave the good stuff to the end and not leave you depressed for the night. So Dharmadipa warned about not getting too involved in the sort of metaphysics and the nature of mind with these talks, and the importance of looking at, you know, the ethical nature of these mental states and so on. That said, I am going to give a little bit of background, because I think it's not to disagree with Dharmadipa at all, but I think it's important to have the sort of, to put a particular sort of perspective on the poisons in a way. So I was also glad that Sutta. So I've got Sabuta written down here, not meaning Sutta. I was glad that Sutta spoke about craving last night, because in a way, hatred and craving are the sort of opposite sides of the same coin. They're very much sort of related. So some of the things I'll be able to say, Sutta sort of referenced last night, which makes it a little bit easier. I think maybe I'll start with Bhante's definition of hatred. So this is from Human Enlightenment. And then I'm going to give Subhuti sort of unpacking it a little bit. So this is Bhante. Aversion is defined as fearful and angered repulsion to get rid of objects of sensory cognition which you dislike, and to exclude them from your ego identity in the hope of getting a sense of security from not having them as part of you. Okay? Do you want that again or not? Yeah. Aversion is defined as fearful and angered. That's interesting, isn't it? Fearful and angered. So there's fear in there. Fearful and angered repulsion to get rid of objects of sensory cognition which you dislike, and to exclude them from your ego identity in the hope of getting a sense of security from, speech marks, not having them as part of you. Okay. So that's Bhante and Human Enlightenment. I'm going to give didn't seem quite the right thing to do to start a talk off with a load of quotes, but I am doing. So this is from Subhuti in Know Your Mind. I just think, I find Subhuti so clear. I love looking at his stuff. I love sort of studying him. He's just, that's why I'm kind of, there's a few quotes that I'll just read out, because he just puts things so well and so clearly. So he's talking about craving here, but again, we're looking at the sense of craving being the deluded mind holding on to things, drawing them towards one, hatred being the pushing away. So there's very much a dynamic sort of relationship there, with the perceived objects pulling towards, pushing away. So he's talking specifically about craving, but as he mentions, you can apply it to hatred. So about half a page. Everyone who is unenlightened is insecure, whether grossly or subtly, about his or her identity. Some people are more psychologically insecure because, for example, they didn't get enough affection when they were children. But there is a more fundamental level of insecurity that is not just a quirk of individual psychology, but a dim perception of a disturbing truth. The fact is, by their very nature, our identities are insecure. For any identity that we cling to is challenged by impermanence and ultimately by death. All the time, the ego is under threat. Consequently, we try to secure it by grasping pleasurable objects or objects that we associate with pleasure, because pleasure gives us the illusion that we are winning the race against destruction and decay. We give unwise attention to such objects, distorting their true nature, seeing them as more pleasurable than they really are, or less painful than they really are, and as having a real substantial existence. In this way, we are always distorting the bare data of contact, turning its object into a contaminated and unreal object. We pay scant attention to the bare sensuous impressions of the object and instead focus upon its pleasurable aspects. In the case of hatred, as we'll see shortly, we do the opposite and over-focus on its painful aspects. What we see is an image projected by our mind, not the object itself. Here we have the very essence of the unenlightened mind. All other afflictions are simply variations of this process. So what we see is an image projected by our mind, not the object itself. Here we have the very essence of the unenlightened mind. All other afflictions are simply variations on this process. So I feel a real sense of relief at hearing those words in a way that there's nothing wrong with the fact that we experience hatred and aversion and ignorance. It's the very nature of mind. It's the very nature of the unenlightened mind. I think that's just a really good sort of place to sort of start, really, to just really have that dharmic perspective that this is the nature of mind. It's not that, you know, that we're all a bit screwed up and we've had to come on retreat because we've got this thing called hatred or aversion or, you know, craving or ignorance. It's not that we are the few and we're trying to sort it out because we've got some problem. Everyone's got this. If you are born, you have this, unless you're fully enlightened. But I just think it's important to kind of acknowledge that and therefore not get into the whole kind of lack of self-meta, being hard on yourself because you know, you experience the poisons, because we're here to gain insight, to work with the poisons, and you know, you can't start doing that if you're sort of not acknowledging that they're there in your life. So it's really important to acknowledge that they're there, to see where they are, to see how they manifest, be very different for each of us and very similar for all of us as well. So I do feel a sense of relief in that, you know, there's nothing wrong with me, there's nothing wrong with you. It's just like, it's the nature of the unenlightened mind. If you're not enlightened, you experience hatred. If you say you don't experience ill will, you're either fully enlightened or you don't know yourself very well. And I probably don't trust you either. So it's our nature to push things away. It's our nature to pull things towards us, to hold on to them. So it really is important to get that before looking at hatred, to get that in the bag, so to speak, to get that under our skin, that element of craving of the poisons. Otherwise, we won't have a clue. You know, we just won't get very far unless we see that this is part of the unenlightened mind. And it's also the fact that, you know, we do need that dharmic perspective on hatred. We do need the perspective I was saying in the group earlier today, working like, what do you do when hatred arises? So we can develop tools, we can develop things in terms of, you know, what to do with hatred when it's present. It's a four right efforts, you know, preventing unskillful mental states arising. I wasn't going to mention them, I hope I remember them, now I have. Preventing unskillful states arising, eradicating ones that have arisen, producing skillful mental states and maintaining those skillful mental states. So that's how we work with it. But it's also, we need as well this dharmic perspective on, it's the nature of the unenlightened mind. Subhuti says that hatred is a reaction to suffering. If there's no suffering, then there's no hatred. So enlightenment is the end of suffering, there's no hatred. So hatred is a reaction to suffering. No suffering, no hatred. If there is suffering, there is hatred. So we do need this sort of perspective on it to start working with it. We can throw out all the crap about being a bad person and this and that. It's like, you know, the bottom line is that we've got to deal with these things. That they're the nature of mind and we have to work with them. And we have to find out, take responsibility, find our own specific way of working with these things. Come in, sir. So So if hatred is a reaction to suffering, then it's related to reality. It's like hatred, you could say, to take it a step further, this is all to try and get a perspective on it, that hatred is our relationship to reality. The same with craving. It's our relationship to reality. It's a reality is impinging on us, impinging in on us all the time. We have a response to reality, and that's pushing it away. That's where we feel the dukkha, and we try and work with the fact that we're going to grow old and die by building this sense of identity. So you could say that hatred is our relationship to reality in a way. I mean, it feels a bit to me as if it's like, these things that, I suppose when you start coming to a Buddhist center or something, you want to be a better person. You want to be a better person. You want to upgrade yourself. I certainly did. I was in a right mess. As probably most of us are when you turn up to a Buddhist center. I wanted certainly a better, kinder, more wholesome, more engaged, what's the word? Version of myself. And that's a good place to start, obviously, but there comes a point where we have to also accept, that we've got these huge glaciers there as well. But with the accepting of that, it's like we've then found this magic portal into the Dharma. So it's not that, oh, it would all be all right if I didn't have hatred, or if I didn't have craving, or if I didn't look at pornography, it'd all be all right. It's not that. It's like these things are portals into the Dharma. So that's where we can start. That's where we can engage. And I think it's important for us to try and get that imaginative connection with the kleshas. That then the kleshas aren't the problem. It's how we deal with them. If we try and ignore them and pretend that we just want to be nice, good Buddhists, that's, you might as well just forget it and just go and lead a sort of crazy life or something. But if we get the right perspective on it, it really does feel like it's some huge portal that you can step into and make real progress with. If you acknowledge that these are there and you take on the karma nirma process as responsibility for how to engage with them. Okay. So with that, we do need to sort of unpack this word hatred a little bit, which in a way I'm not going to quite do, but I suppose what I'm saying is we need to try and get a sense of where it lies, where it lurks, or where it rages within our experience. And again, it'll be different for everyone. Some people are more prone to it, some people are less prone to it. But we all have it. We all have a version of some kind. So we need to develop this awareness of when we push things away that we don't like. So we experience suffering. As Sabit said, hatred is the reaction to suffering. He also goes on to say, hatred extends beyond the experience of suffering to the perceived causes of suffering. So hatred extends beyond the experience of suffering to the perceived causes of suffering. In particular, hatred focuses on people who are the causes of our harm. It might not even be, I was thinking about that. In particular, hatred focuses on people who are the causes of our harm. I don't think I'm ever harmed by anyone, actually. But I still hate people, if that makes sense. It's kind of like, he does talk about it here in terms of harm and holding grudges, but I don't know if anyone's really harmed me. But I still sort of experience sort of ill will, hatred. Just with that, with the sort of identifying, I'm partly thinking that hatred's a broad spectrum, as with all experience, and it's almost like hatred's this big stake in the ground on that spectrum of experience. And you might be right that up there against it and want to kill someone, or you might be quite a bit away from it. And just because you're away from it doesn't mean it's not the nature of hatred, or it's not the nature of ill will, if that makes sense. So just because you think, oh, well, I'm not a hateful type, which, some of you might not be able to, because we've all got, different kind of weights of the poisons. But that doesn't, again, it's just that doesn't mean it's not present. And we need to really sort of try and identify where it is in our life, where we experience unpleasant sensation, push the object away. And this is usually with regards or most strongly in relationship to a person, to an individual. That's usually the object of our hatred. Although I have got pretty damn cross with inanimate objects in the past, but that's probably not hatred. It's the will to desire to destroy inanimate objects. So another very interesting point from Subhuti. So it's not just that we perceive harm and want to protect ourselves, but it's also the desire to restore one's sense of self. So it's not just that we perceive harm and want to protect ourselves, but it's also the desire to restore one's sense of self. With that, he says, not just that we experience that suffering as that. So not just that we experience that suffering as diminishing our sense of self, but we wish then to reassert our identity. I was thinking, I always end up mentioning my girlfriend in talks. It's a bit embarrassing. She's probably going to listen to this as well. But when I last saw Keith today, they had an argument with her, as we tend to. It's fine, we're getting on very well. But I was just very aware when Subhuti said this, of this sense of, it's just the dynamics of argument. She said something and I immediately felt diminished, a bit embarrassed, a bit crappy. And what immediately happened in the flash of a nanosecond, I have to come back. And it's coming back, pushing back. She was outside the car. I was this side. It's like, not physically, but immediately I want to come back. That diminishes the other person. They want to come back. Bang, bang, argument. But I just thought that's very, that we have this sense of identity, which we perceive, as being diminished, and we need to reassert it. Desire to reassert our sense of self. So it's probably quite good to sort of notice that when you feel annoyed or upset in communication, just noticing that, what is that? Can you begin to notice that quality of diminishing, of diminishment? Is that even a word? I don't know. But noticing that quality of, do you feel sort of small? And I'm just making words up now. Do you feel, a little bit inferior or something? So we have this sort of ill-fitting sense of ourselves as being fixed and real. And that, this view of ourselves as being fixed, substantial, is very easily challenged by others and very easily blown down. Sort of like a house of cards. When you sort of make a little house out of cards and pile them up, a pyramid of cards. So it feels like our sense of self is, well, certainly mine, very quickly blown down. Like someone can say something and it's down, and you just got to put it back up as quick as you can, and clumsily and off, sort of harshly a lot of the time. So that's when we sort of come back with this sort of ill will in a way. So moving on, as craving falsifies its objects in terms of exaggerating the pleasant. So hatred exaggerates the unpleasant, exaggerates the painful, the ugly, the offensive aspects of the other person. So it's very willful hatred. It's a willful ignoring. It's got quite a volitional quality to it. It's a willful ignoring of the pleasant aspects of the other person. And you can see this in like the fourth stage of the metta-bhava. If there's someone that you're finding difficult and you put them in the fourth stage, if you keep doing it and the metta's working well, you'll see that there's other, you can't deny that there's other aspects to them, that they are generous sometimes, that they are quite popular, or they were kind to you, or they're quite clear, whatever it is. And that's a true picture. But it's like that true picture sometimes in itself mildly offensive because you know you've got it wrong. But it's this deliberate, willful view of keeping someone in a particular sort of silhouette in a way. And yeah, just the metaphor of the particular four stages, very good in terms of like just trying to see them differently, open up to the fact that you've got them categorised in a certain way, and that's not the whole picture. You know, that's not the whole picture. So, you know, hatred falsifies its objects, and we need to sort of learn through meta, empathy, all these things, how to get a clearer, more realistic impression of the objects of our hatred. Okay, so I'll talk now about the secondary outgrowths of hatred. An interesting little list. So firstly, rage, krodha. Subhuti says the overwhelming desire to attack the hated object, to destroy them, destroy it or them. Rage sweeps the mind away in a wave of emotion that loses all sense of proportion. I've certainly experienced this a few years ago. I was in Nottingham, and thankfully it was just on the mental level, but it felt very dangerous actually. I mean, I don't know quite what the full definition of rage is, whether it actually needs to become verbal or physical, but I certainly have a few times clearly felt it on a mental level, very, very clearly. I just remember having a very, very strong desire to, I mean, it sounds comical, but to throw this person I was in conflict with at the time out of the fourth floor of the Buddhist Center window. I mean, it was really clear. This image just kept coming up of just getting him in full bodily, throwing him out the window. And it felt quite clear in a way. It just felt like the absolute overwhelm. It wasn't kind of, didn't feel hot and sweating, I'm going to kill that bastard. It was just like, I just wanted him dead. I wanted him out the window. And I've had it before with, no one's going to talk to me after this, are they? But I've had it before on retreat. It was very interesting. Someone had said a bit of an unpleasant comment to me about something at the beginning of the retreat. I didn't even know this person. And then during the meditation retreat, very clear, lucid hatred came up. I was walking, you know, this image, I was walking behind this person with a huge baseball bat and just, you know, strong desire to kill them. I mean, it really was. But what struck me about it was the strength of it, the clarity of it. It wasn't fussy and complicated. It was just, I want to kill that person. There wasn't even that thought there. It was just overtaken by this sort of thing. Thankfully, it was just a mental level. Didn't go further than that. But I really felt, my Christ, this is dangerous, you know. And I could really sort of empathise with... This is all getting a bit heavy with people end up killing other people. I don't know if this is helpful. Maybe I'll stop going on about killing, but it is interesting though, because I will tie it up with something later that Subhuti says. I mean, most of you will probably know this quote. Subhuti says in his System on Dharma of Dharma Life talks. Sorry if you've heard this before, it's an oft-quoted little scenario. Subhuti was living at Padmaloka. He heard a load of noise and disturbance in the lean-to by the kitchen. He went in and there was one community member holding a knife to the gut of another community member, a kitchen knife. And Subhuti went in, he shouted, and the guy dropped the knife and ran off. And Subhuti went to see Bhante later, and he was obviously understandably quite disturbed by this. And he went to Bhante and he said, I can't believe that someone in the community would do that. And, you know, he was really shocked and upset and understandable. And he said, it's the one of the few times he's seen Bhante let himself out of his cage. And he turned to him and he said, don't ever think you're not capable of that. So he just very directly, he didn't say, yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? He just said, very strong, said, don't ever think you're not capable of that. So I suppose what I'm getting at is the depth of it, that in the right conditions, with the right provocation, things can change very, very sort of easily for us. So while we're in good conditions, while there is, you know, a civilized society, well, let's try and work on the clashes, work on the poisons. It's all sounding a bit drastic, isn't it? Okay, so that's rage. Secondly, I have the secondary outgrowth as resentment, upanaha. So this is the tendency to nurse hatred while keeping it hidden and waiting for a time to vent it. The tendency to nurse hatred while keeping it hidden and waiting for a time to vent it. So it's much more considered than rage. Rage is this overwhelming sort of experience. Much more considered than that. Sabir says it's spiritually very dangerous. He says if one has a predisposition towards it, one should work very hard to eliminate it, and especially not to bring it into the spiritual community. Excuse me. So spiritually very dangerous. So there's that sense of, it's got a volitional quality to it. You know, you're holding on to it. You're not doing anything about it. You're waiting. You're biding your time. And the hatred is quietly burning in the background. When it gets the opportunity, it will burn more brightly, and you'll through speech or action, you'll sort of, you know, bring it up. So it's carrying a grudge. It says this can be a grudge to a person, to a group of people, to a whole nation. Grudges can be carried on through generations. So, you know, this is some of the background, in a way, to, you know, why you see world wars or countries invading each other, different football clubs attacking each other, all sorts of things like that. So it's holding a grudge, holding a very particular view, and waiting to act on it. In Know Your Mind, Bhante says that we nurse it and want to carry on being angry. So again, this volitional aspect of nursing it and wanting to carry on being angry. Okay, so that's resentment. So next, spite or pradana. Pradana. So Sabir says that rage and resentment have specific objects. He said that spite is more of a disposition. In Know Your Mind, Bhante says that this is interesting. He says it's connected to slyness and concealment, which Surita spoke about last night. So in slyness and concealment is the idea of, you know, you kind of come into the room as if you've not disappeared for 24 hours, and, you know, as if you haven't been up to whatever you've been up to. But spite can be responding defensively all the time to what it is you've been doing, so maybe it's like guilty conscience or something. So it's keeping people back. With, you know, become very defensive. So you know, you'd be very defensive to someone who's just asked, like, even how are you doing, or where were you last night? Did you have a good night? It's this sort of spike in his back. So it's this defensiveness, similar to slyness and concealment. So someone might be quite reasonable, but you sort of jump down their throat and. Sabita says it's a kind of spikiness of character. It's a sort of, again, this sort of trying to keep people back by just being sort of mildly aggressive, really. Fourthly, envy. I can't read my writing. Iasia, I don't know what the Pali is, I apologise. So it's very particular envy. It's the displeasure at the good or the success in other people. So Sabuti says, if we inwardly accuse ourselves of lacking achievement, worth or popularity, especially if the accusation is not fully conscious, we may feel hurt by the success of others. So we experience ourselves as lacking achievement, not being very worthy. And, you know, through that, We see someone that we perceive to be successful and we experience ill will towards them because they're more successful than us, because we immediately feel inferior to them. We respond with ill will, sometimes, well, often verbally, to try and narrow the gap. Or we just dislike them in our mind to try and narrow the gap between where we are and where they are. So it's, in a way, it's this house of cards. It's like the top two cards have fallen down and we've got to put them back up by, you know, being quite critical of the person, or, you know, just thoughts of ill will towards them. Because we perceive, you know, we're trying to narrow the gap, we perceive they're better than us. And again, we feel sort of diminished by that. So we're trying to bring the person down to our level. So Beatty says, I suspect that we greatly underestimate the power of envy as a force in personal relationships and society as a whole. It is a destructive but often invisible emotion because by its very nature cannot be frankly avowed. So the first three secondary afflictions, you know, rage, resentment, and the other one, spite. Oh, that's coming. So we can, in a way, sort of justify this to other people. You know, there's a we can get into sort of reasons why such a person has, you know, has taken the wrong course of action or said such a thing that we didn't like. So we can sort of, and people can often empathise with us, particularly if we feel that we've been wronged, and we give our reasons. People can empathise with why we might experience ill will. I'm not saying that's right either, but with envy. It's just embarrassing to say that you feel inferior to another person and you don't like them because of that. I mean, no one wants to admit that. That's really embarrassing. I only realised that I experienced envy about, certainly after ordination, it was a few years ago, I just realised there were some order members. Funnily enough, they were usually around my age or a little bit older, and I perceived them to have a bit of a better practice than me. But I never quite knew why I didn't like them. It's two I sort of think about, a Dharmacharya and a Dharmacharina. I didn't even know them that well, but I just sort of didn't like them. And after a while, I realised it was jealousy. It was envy. You know, I couldn't just hold myself that, oh, they're just a bit more sorted out than me, actually. If someone's quite a bit more sorted out, I'd be all reverential and kind and I get something back. Someone's just a little bit more sorted out, I'm a bit like, a bit suspicious, or sort of, you know, I just want to. It seems to sort of illustrate the fact that where I'm at a little bit more, as opposed to being a sort of humble Dharma practitioner and, you know, trying to sort of engage in Kalyana Mitta with someone on a sort of vertical level. I find it can be more difficult if it's someone who's just, you know, a bit more sorted out than me, because I get into this thing of, well, you should be like that. You know, why aren't you like that? Why aren't you a bit more? So this competitiveness, I suppose it is. Competitiveness. Okay. So there's a very, so that's hatred and the secondary afflictions. There's a very important point. That Subhuti draws out, that I'll quote, around hatred. Well, it's around all of the sort of ignorance, hatred, and delusion. But for me, for some reason, it really works with it's particularly adept for hatred. It says, but for all the evil they can produce underneath them, that's the hatred in the secondary arisings, for all the evil they can produce underneath them is a kind of neutral primal energy. Something that is part of human nature that becomes hatred when it is checked or frustrated. This energy is not itself something to be extirpated or denied, but something to be acknowledged and transformed. The secret of dealing with aggressive energy is to find a positive outlet for it, to channel it before it becomes hatred. This is no doubt one of the major issues of life, and especially of a life devoted to the Dharma. So I find that very helpful, that underneath them is a kind of neutral primal energy. And, you know, the secret is how do we contact that energy, actually, and how do we acknowledge it and transform it? So we're not going to be able to contact that energy if we really sort of feel that. I'm not saying you're filled with hatred and you don't realise it, but if we're just trying to be nice Buddhists, we're not going to be able to contact that energy. We have a great capacity for energy as human beings, and we're certainly not going to move towards enlightenment if we can't contact that energy. And that sort of primal energy is a lot of the time, you know, moving down the avenues of the kleshas, of the poisons. So it's how do we acknowledge it? How do we work with it? Major issue of life, and especially of a life devoted to the Dharma. So we need to be careful how we transform it. We're working with very strong energies. We need to find them and contact them first. Often we can contact them through, this is the thing with this, you know, these portals. It's like we've all got trigger points in our life. We've all got certain things that really trigger us, that get us into ill will or craving or whatever it is. We need to find, because that's where this primal energy is to be found, in those places. So what, you know, notice, and this is, I mean, this for me is just a green light to look at our mind and the nasty bits of it. So what are the parts of our mind that we react to? Because that's where this primal energy is to be found, and that's where we can start working with it. So that for me, again, gives me allowance to really look into this stuff, to really have a good look at hatred. Okay. So, goodwill. I knew this was going to happen. I've got so little to say on goodwill. To be fair, Subhuti didn't say an awful lot about it. That's my excuse. Subhuti's fault. Joke. So goodwill, advesa, or non-hatred. So I've got a quote here where Subhuti draws out the relationship between goodwill and ill will. So the key to understanding the roots of goodwill lies in the question of our sense of identity. Hatred and craving both emerge from our fundamental feeling of insecurity about our very existence as a separate self, a feeling that is so deeply imbued in the structure of our ordinary minds that we usually don't know it's there. Hatred is our attempt to resolve that anxiety by removing anything that seems to threaten us, while through craving we seek to secure ourselves by including in our identity anything we think will protect us and solidify our being. Goodwill then is not based in that fundamental insecurity. So goodwill is not based in that fundamental insecurity. Goodwill emerges from a happy weakening of our sense of being separate. Goodwill emerges from our happy weakening of our sense of being separate. A sense of connection and expansion to include in our concern the being of others. We sense that the life in them is the same as the life in us. We feel empathy for them, and we reach out to them as if they are, to a greater or lesser extent, parts of ourselves, or we parts of them. So just very good there, this direct relationship. This is what ill will looks like. This is what goodwill looks like. So the insecurity of the, you know, the poisons based on dukkha, goodwill not based on that insecurity, based on wisdom. So he says the word goodwill sort of sounds unremarkable, but he says it's the bottom rung of a golden ladder ascending to the highest selflessness that identifies spontaneously with all that lives and is embodied for us in the figure of the Buddha himself. So yeah, I don't particularly connect with the word goodwill. It sounds a little bit kind of weak or something like that, but very important to have a sense of, you know, to have an imaginative connection with the fact that it's a bottom rung of a golden ladder ascending to the highest selflessness. Sabi says, a growing sense that goodwill is a growing sense that we cannot harm other people. So you probably, the very fact that you're here, and as far as I can see, there's no psychopaths on the retreat. That was a joke. A growing, a growing sense that we cannot harm other people. We've all got that. The very fact that you've asked for ordination and all that involves means, you know, you're having to engage with positive emotion, with the engagement, with the development of metta. So, you know, whatever view you have of yourself, you are on one of the rungs of this golden ladder. We recognise that on a fundamental, we recognise our fundamental identity with others. So others avoid painful experience and want pleasant experience. And it's just really getting, you know, what's his name? Shantideva really goes into this in the Bodhicharya Avatara, this, you know, this exchanging self for other, you know, a very, very important, very sort of fundamental sort of Buddhist teaching in a way. The very mechanisms within which I'm standing here, not quite enjoying feeling a little bit tense and sort of happy enough to be talking, I'm thinking about it, be happy when the talk's over. That's just the desire for happiness. There's all of you got different things, exactly that mechanism, the desire to move away from unpleasant experience, to move towards the pleasant, that very mechanism, that little clockwork bit of mechanics in all is found in me is exactly the same as is found in you all, and is exactly the same as the man sitting next to you. Exactly the same mechanism reflected in each other. And that's what we're trying to connect with. And that's metta. That's what we're trying to connect with. That real imaginative connection with light. You know, we all feel the same. Everyone wants to be happy. It's not just Buddhists who want to be happy. That everyone wants to be happy. It's part of human nature. That's the thing that we're connecting with. And to the extent that we can connect with that, be willing to connect with that, really, you know, really engaging ourselves in an imaginative way with that connection. That's metta. That's us stepping onto, moving up this golden ladder. Sabita says that we become increasingly sensitive to the pain that others feel when we do this. Not only that, we actively desire to avoid being the cause of that pain. So we, you know, as we realise that this mechanism is the same in others, we become very sensitive to the fact that they want to avoid harm. And we become sensitive to the fact from that we want to avoid being the cause of harm to others. It goes further than that. We don't just want to avoid harming, but we actively want others to be well, and we actively want to contribute to their well-being. So it then moves into the world, you know, we're actively following up that desire that we want others to be well. And again, it's good for us to make a connection with that. We might kind of think, oh, I mean, you might just be practicing the Dharma for yourself, but it's not that easy I think once you start practicing the Dharma, you just got a bit of a sense of it. It's not that difficult. It's a natural human capacity to be able to empathise with others. So I don't think we have to do that much work to start engaging with that, start unlocking that, start feeling that sense of identity and empathy with others, and the fact that, you know, no one in this room wants to experience unpleasant sensations, and everyone wants to be well. So, you know, we can, I think that's why I just like this image of a golden ladder. It's like, and I don't want to make it sound all simplified and sentimental, but the rungs of a ladder aren't very far apart. So we can just choose to imaginatively connect with this very basic fact of others' well-being and contribute to it. I mean, sometimes that contributing to others' well-being, it might not look like we think it's going to look like. You know, sometimes I just think, well, I'm not that fussed about contributing to the welfare of others. And I do feel that. But then I look at my life and I look at the way I respond and I think, well, no, that can't be true. So it's like there is in my life a desire to help others. That's why I'm on the ordination team. That's why I wanted to move to Padmaloka. Could have been easier. I could have stayed in Nottingham near Coosla Davy. But I didn't want to, and it wasn't just because I thought I'd have a nice life at Padmaloka. There was some other element in it. I'm not trying to say I'm some amazing bodhisattva, far from it. But it's just clocking the fact that we do want others to be well, and we do act on that. And the more we recognise that, the more we can actually follow that up. So our Dharma life becomes less about us and does become more about sort of opening out to help others. And I think there's even something about the fact that you've all asked for ordination, that effective going for refuge is the point where it's almost witness that you genuinely, on a deeper level, are engaged and want to help others. Not that to be, as Suita said, you want to teach, but it's like, oh, you do feel an empathy and a sense of engagement when someone walks into the Buddhist centre or the group that you're doing. You know they want something and you want to respond. Might be, motives might be mixed. You might want to think, you know, you might want to look well. If there's someone you find attractive, that always helps. But underneath that, there is also a desire to help others. I think it is good to be able to recognise that as well, without getting all egotistical and mental about it as well. So just a sort of final quote from Subhuti, on a similar vein. However, gradually our sense of our own separate identity is dissolved in a larger identification with life itself as it manifests all around us. We are more and more prepared to lay aside our own interests in order to serve others, and we do it joyfully and spontaneously because we feel for that life in them as much as we do for our own life. I'll just read that last little bit. We lay aside our own interest in order to serve others, and we do it joyfully and spontaneously because we feel for that life in them as much as we do for our own life. That's the essentials of it, really. I wasn't going to say anything about it, but just to sort of try and tie up the chapter. Subhuti says at the end, he talks about malice and compassion as being the two extremes of real hatred and real, you know, goodwill. So he says malice is the actual enjoyment of inflicting harm on another, and compassion is, you know, the actual enjoyment in seeing other beings benefiting in whatever way it is. And he talks about the Brahma Viharas as ways of metta contacting the different states of being that human beings are in. So that's all I have to say. Goodwill, hatred and goodwill, how to work with them. Yeah. Thank you.